So, just to remind everybody what we're doing for this block, we're treating these four topics as kind of a continuous lecture, and I'll decide after today what I'll kind of condense out of next week, just given that we'll probably not finish today's material either. So we were at Roman numeral 2 on Tuesday's lecture. We had gone through this basic vocabulary exercise of building up a concept of the state of a very general character by discussing the meaning of practices, political practices, domination, power, etc., culminating in a concept of the state. Now, where we ended up there, the state defined as this superordinate institution of centralized domination over territory, etc., there was really no content to that definition. It doesn't say anything about whether the state is a class state, whether it's a patriarchal state, whether it's a theocratic state. There's nothing about the content of its form, anything about its how it actually works. It was just a formal definition of what kind of organization counts as being a state. What we're now going to be doing is putting content into these ideas. So we are taking this general concept of the state and then developing a specifically Marxian theory of the state rather than just a abstract concept of the state. Some Marxist discussions infuse the very concept with this class theory. And as I explained, I think it's better to try to develop your concepts independently, somewhat independently. I mean, these concepts are designed to fit well into a Marxist theory, but to not build your conclusions into the definitions of your concepts. So in the second part of today's lecture, when we get to the question of what makes the capitalist state a capitalist state, those are propositions. Those are discoveries about how the world works. Those are not definitional. Those are things which you can then argue with that the empirical evidence doesn't support the argument. Whereas the definitions that I discussed last time, you know, you could argue that maybe some alternative definition would be more useful for some purposes, but it's not really a case that my specification of politics, political practices as the production and transformation of social relations, that you can say, no, that's wrong. Well, that's the concept of politics that I'm using for these purposes. And then we can decide whether it needs amendment in order to be as powerful and useful as we want. Okay, so that's the kind of contrast here. So it's not exactly prologue, because we did a lot of theoretical work to get those concepts lined up and nicely sorted out. Perhaps too neatly sorted out, but still sorted. Now we're going to move into the substance. And the first part of that discussion, I think, is to briefly talk about what is often thought of as the classical Marxian view of the state. Classical, in this sense, it's a little bit of a stylized way of talking. You know, a lot of theoretical traditions talk about the classical concepts and then how they get modified. It isn't the case that even in the classical period, these concepts were uncontested. Marx famously said while he was alive, "I am not a Marxist," and "je ne suis pas un marxiste," he said it. I don't know why it was in French. It must have been in the context of a debate in France. And by that, he meant that there were all sorts of followers of him who had stylized his ideas in a way more rigid and dogmatic way than he felt comfortable with, even though there was a clear pedigree, a clear continuity between things he had written and what were being said as Marxist. Well, what I'm calling the classical theory of the state, which builds the idea of the state around what is called the base and superstructure model. This was indeed a way that people in the Marxist tradition, in communist parties, in revolutionary groups, in Marxist study groups, talked about the state. In the, you know, much of the sort of first half or so of the 20th century, late 19th century, the base superstructure way of talking about it was common. it became inscribed in the official doctrines of communist parties that used this language. And when it became so inscribed, it actually got stripped down in a way that isn't congruent with some of the things I'm going to be describing here. My characterization of the base and superstructure model is very close to the way Jerry Cohen, in the book we'll be reading at the end of the semester, Karl Marx's Theory of History of Defense, the way he talks about the base and superstructure. And it's actually a pretty subtle argument, and an argument which I think has at its core some very profound insights. And while the expression base and superstructure has a kind of rigidity to it, and the architectural metaphor that it suggests doesn't really fit the more process way of thinking about these things today, nevertheless, I don't think one should reject this way of talking out of hand without appropriating from it the insights. And you'll see how that plays itself out, both with respect to the state and perhaps even more when we get to the question of ideology. So first task is to really explain, what does this even mean? What are we talking about when we say that the state is a key institution or structure that's part of the superstructure of society? What does this really mean? The simplest, well, it's not so much the simplest. The way to think about this is to understand that this way of talking about the state is a form of functional explanation. It sees, it understands and theorizes the state, in terms of the functions it fills in a society. The state fulfills an essential function in reproducing the class relations of a capitalist society. The base superstructure model can be called equivalently, so I think this is an equivalent idea, a class-centered functional view of the state. To understand this, I first need to explain a little bit more what the word superstructure means, why that term, what that term bears, and then I'm going to spend a little bit of time explaining the logic of functional explanation, because I think this is something that people are very confused about, and it's worth spending a little bit of time just to make it clear. I may have mentioned this a little bit, and we sort of touched on it a little bit in the discussions of race and gender, perhaps. I don't remember exactly how much I invoke this, but it's worth pausing and giving it a little bit of attention. So first, the idea of superstructure. Here's how I think you should think about it. Superstructures support bases. Without superstructures, the base would collapse. Cohen gives a nice little image to kind of get this in mind. Imagine you have four posts, and then you put a roof on top of the posts. And the reason for putting the roof on top of the posts is to prevent the posts from falling over, because the roof holds them in place, right? So we could say those posts are the base. The roof is the superstructure. Without the superstructure, the base falls apart. You could ask of the architect, let us suppose that this was a situation where the purpose of the roof was not to keep the rain off your head, but the roof was put on because you needed these posts for various purposes. The posts you hung things from, and they were served a decorative function in your garden or whatever. You needed the posts, and you ask, well, why is the roof designed the way it is? And the answer is, it's designed that way because it's necessary to support the base. You've explained the roof by its consequences for stabilizing the posts. bases explain superstructures in the sense that the explanation for the presence of the roof is the need to hold up the posts, the struts. That kind of explanation is called a functional explanation. Superstructures understood in this way are not epiphenomena. Remember, I think I invoked that arcane word. An epiphenomenon is something which is a reflection of something else but does not itself have important consequences. It's pure surface. Well, superstructures are absolutely not epiphenomena. To say that the state is in the superstructure or that ideology is part of the superstructure is to say they're massively important. They have huge consequences. They wouldn't be part of the superstructure if they did not have consequences. They have huge consequences. But they are nevertheless explained by virtue of those consequences. That's why they are the way they are. That is the core idea of a functional explanation. So let's turn to that, and I'll sort that out a little bit.
Thank you, Gosh.
Yeah.
How do you perceive the idea of Harris and Sutterson of introducing a structure so they would have kind of base, like basic materials, kind of ecology, demography, technology, economy, then structure, what people do, like politics, stratification, superstructure, how people explain what they do, like general ideology, arts, music?
No, that's a completely different framework.
But how do you consider it kind of useful, or it's kind of too complicated?
Well, it's just a different point. How people explain what they do doesn't tell you that their explanations are necessary to stabilize the structure. So that is a simple causal claim, that people live their lives in relations and then they explain what they do. That doesn't say anything about the consequences of the forms of explanations for the stability of their relations. The base superstructure argument says something very strong, and it's a very powerful, it may be wrong, but it's a very powerful and strong claim that the way we think about what we do, the ways we think about it, so this is the ideology part, help to stabilize what we do. That doesn't mean just that it's a reflection of what we do or that it's explained by what we do, but that it is the way it is because it has consequences for our actions. That is, ideology serves to stabilize our social relations. The state serves to stabilize our class relations. And that, I think, is what the base superstructure model is all about. It's about the stabilization or reproduction of something and the sense in which it's superstructure rather than the base is because that helps you understand the functional relation. The base doesn't exist in order to support the superstructure. The base exists and needs mechanisms of reproduction, and the state provides those mechanisms of reproduction. That's the argument. And that's why the argument has a real content to it. You know, one way of thinking about what it means to say there's content to an argument is that it may be wrong. Yeah?
So I have a hypothetical question. What do you think Marx would say, or other Marxist theories about why the Soviet Union as a state collapsed? Is it that the space didn't match the superstructure?
So here's, I think, the way to think about that problem. Marx, writing in the 19th century, would have predicted that the Soviet Union would have collapsed very quickly. He would have predicted the attempt at building that kind of society in the 1920s was doomed. It was impossible. It was outside of the limits of possibility. And it simply could not, under those material conditions, produce a society. What he would have been surprised at is that it lasted for 70 years. That would have been a surprise. That would have needed some really strong explanations. The strength of the state superstructure that was constructed on those foundations is at least part of the answer to the question. How did an economy, which was so ill-suited to the development of the productive forces, which was his essential argument, and so out of tune with historical possibility, how could it survive? Well, it survived because a very effective apparatus of reproduction was created. But that apparatus of reproduction could not overcome the fundamental contradictions of such a society, and then eventually it unravels. I mean, that would be a kind of the way of that Carl might have reckoned, you know, Charlie might have reconciled the, you know, the central theoretical ideas of historical materialism. The base superstructure model fits into historical materialism. We'll see how that, how it fits into the grand history, theory of history at the end of the course. Okay, let's look at functional explanations, see how they work. The area of scientific theory where functional explanations figure most prominently is biology. And particularly evolutionary biology has provided a way of elaborating these functional explanations. But even in the absence of evolution, functional explanations were present all the time in biology. Why do birds have hollow wings? So that's a particular property of birds. We want to explain why they have hollow wings. Well, it turns out if you study the aerodynamics and mechanics of bird flight, you'd realize if their wings weren't hollow, the wings would be too heavy and the birds wouldn't be able to fly. And so a natural explanation for the hollowness of wings is there's a particular consequence of hollowness of wings that matters for birds, namely, it enables them to fly. That's explaining a property by its consequences. Why do giraffes have long necks? It enables them to eat the leaves of the acacia tree. It's a consequence of long necks that giraffes, but not horses, can eat the leaves, or zebras, I guess, in the relevant ecology, cannot eat the leaves of the acacia tree. And that's indeed a good explanation. All sorts of biological properties are explained by their functions. You know, why the heart has two chambers, why, et cetera, et cetera, why our skeletons are articulated the way they are. All of these things are explained by what their consequences are, and in particular by their beneficial consequences, where beneficial means for the functioning of the whole of which these are a part. Right? Now, biology has this fantastic theoretical structure that helps us make sense of this, and it's called natural selection. So the theory of natural selection provides us with the underlying mechanisms by which it comes to pass that a particular structure is explained by its consequences. Normally, we think of explanation as being of the form that there's a temporal relationship between a cause and its effects, so that a cause explains an effect rather than an effect explains its cause. Right? So a cause, so there's something weird about functional explanations. It seems to invert the usual causal structure. Well, natural selection gets us out of that bind. It provides us with the underlying causal mechanism that explains the functional explanation, or that generates the functional explanation. The functional explanation is still functional explanation. It still is the case that it's the properties of the hollow wing that enables a bird to fly that explains why they're hollow. The consequence of hollowness explains why it's hollow. Again, that sounds a little strange. How can the consequences of something explain the thing itself? But natural selection provides us with the appropriate way of thinking about it. So, functional explanations are rampant in biology. Very few people reject them. Some people, some philosophers have sort of picky little points about it, but it's a lot of that has to do with how you're going to use words rather than the substance of the point. It's rampant in biology. It used to be, in the history of human thought, that functional explanations were also common in astronomy, you know, and in the natural world, not the biological world. So people used to say, why does the sun shine? Because it provides us with warmth. You know, why does it rain? So that the flowers will grow. Now, no modern scientist would say that that's a legitimate explanation. We don't explain the presence of rain by virtue of its benevolent consequences for flowers. But in medieval science, that was the explanation, that God so ordered the world that everything would fit together, and God was the natural, you know, the surrogate for natural selection. God in his wisdom saw to it that there would be rain so that flowers would grow. So God provided the behind-the-scenes mechanism that explained the functional properties. That's no longer part of science. I don't think there's any astrophysicist who invokes functional explanations. You may have equilibria of forces that explain the stability of solar systems, but not because that's what but not an argument of the form, we have this equilibrium so that people will thrive on Earth. That would not be part of a legitimate explanation. Where there's debate is whether functional explanations have any role in social life. Is it legitimate to have a functional explanation of our institutions, our structures? Let me give you what is, I think, a really nice example from anthropology of a functional explanation. This is from Malinowski's famous work on Trobriand Islanders. The observation to be explained is that Trobriand Islanders fish in two different natural environments, in lagoons and in the open sea. They have massively elaborate rituals for open sea fishing with the local, you know, the shaman of their community blessing the voyage with all sorts of sacrifices and other things done when they fish in the open sea, but not when they fish in the lagoons. And the question is, why? How do you explain, and this is a very stable structural feature of their social life, rituals for open sea fishing, not for the lagoon. Malinowski adopts basically a functional explanation, and I've drawn a picture at the bottom. This comes from Art Stinchcomb's book, Constructing Social Theories, which explains the logic. So what we're trying to explain is fishing rituals. That's our object of explanation. There is a ecological fact, which is that there is objective danger in open sea fishing, but not in lagoon fishing. The objective danger of open sea fishing generates anxiety and fear on the part of fishermen. It creates anxiety to go out into the open sea. The anxiety and fear stimulates the production of rituals which reduce the fear. And when the fear is sufficiently reduced, the pressure to build more rituals declines. So you get eventually an equilibrium. And through that feedback process, that circular causal structure like that is called a feedback process. Through that feedback process, you end up with a stable equilibrium where you end up with a low enough level of fear to enable you to do the fishing, but that low enough level of fear is continually stimulated by the fear-producing mechanism of actual danger. So you have the rituals. Occasionally, you get blown away by a hurricane when you're out there. That reminds people that it really is dangerous, and thus this circular causal structure remains in place. That's exactly the structure of a functional explanation. Now you might ask, well, there's an arrow from anxiety and fear producing rituals, a plus arrow. We understand the minus arrow from fishing rituals to anxiety. We understand why that makes calms people's nerves. But how is it that the anxiety and fear in the first place generated the rituals? What's the, where is that positive arrow coming from? To say it's natural selection would imply the following, that people randomly, remember natural selection comes through random mutations, that people randomly try things in the face of this fear. They do all sorts of crazy things, and some of them reduce anxiety and some of them don't. And over time, just through this kind of random process, the anxiety-reducing things get stabilized and the ones that don't reduce anxiety don't. Right, so that would be the kind of mindless view, that people are just randomly doing stuff. I think that's not the right way to think about it in social inventions. Rather, there are wise people. There are people in that community who really do have insights into human emotion, psychology, and who are inventive. They're both insightful and creative, and there's a kind of guided natural selection going on. There are shamans and wise men and wise women who are inventing solutions to social problems and who also have a capacity to winnow the good experiments from the bad experiments. So it's not as if they create a full-blown complicated ritual out of nothing to begin with. No, there is an evolutionary process in the way they experiment. You know, a shaman will experiment with different rituals. But it's guided by insight and reflection. Thus, lurking inside of functional explanations is an allied but different explanation called an intentional explanation. That is, the purposes of actors figure in the mechanisms that generate the structures in the first place. So it's sometimes it can be more of a random process. People are sort of, you know, without insight, producing solutions, and then the successful ones stick. But I think that's not the general case. The general case is guided selection, so that there's purposes that drive the search for a solution to what is experienced by the actors as a problem. And in the case of getting adequate fish in a fishing culture, when people know that they can't get enough fish just from the lagoon or the right kinds of fish or whatever. I mean, I don't know enough about the ecology to make clear statements about that. But given that situation, there will be cultural creators, people who build these new institutions and these new relations. So that's the structure of a functional explanation. Now that is what is at the heart of the theory of the state in classical Marxism. Yeah?
You're saying that intentional explanations are a subset or a functional explanation?
No, they're not a subset. They are a part of the mechanism which generates the feedback loop. Right? So let me give you another example. We observe in the world of capitalism that capitalist firms are effective profit-maximizing enterprises, and that they have a range of strategies to maximize profits. Now, we might ask the question, why do capitalist firms have these profit-maximizing strategies, the particular strategies they have? The answer is typically that competition between firms means that if you don't have a profit-maximizing strategy, you're going to go out of business. Now, what does that mean exactly? It means that profit-maximizing strategies explain the stability of the firm, and there's something that is constantly threatening that stability of the firm, namely competition. Now, you could imagine at some early time capitalists randomly adopted their strategies without purpose. That is, they had a book of strategies and they just flipped through it and randomly picked one. Over time, firms that were so unlucky as to pick a bad strategy go out of business. Firms which are lucky and pick a good strategy stay in business. So that over time, you end up only with firms that had good profit-maximizing strategies. Even though it was never the purpose of anybody to pick a good strategy, they just randomly pick strategies. That would be the pure natural selection version. Right, that would be like mutations. Intentions, purposes enter the story, therefore, by making the process of ending up with those good strategies, in a sense, more efficient than it would otherwise be. Because the actors have enough insight to realize the consequences of having bad strategies, and therefore they seek good strategies. But they often make mistakes, and so it's still the case that there's a selection process going on. That the bad choices, even if they were well-intentioned, still get punished by the competition. And so you still do have this circular feedback process, which explains the stability of the final, quote, equilibrium. Yeah.
I was going to ask if this explanation, like the anthropological one, is very similar to what often Wiesenthal were talking about when they were talking about historical logic and about how militants learn over time and things like that.
I mean, I think there certainly is a connection there. You know, I'd have to really decipher the Offie and Wiesenthal argument to see if they are in the end making a functional explanation. Not all learning would have that functional character, because to have the functional character, you have to be explaining a structural feature, which you're explaining by its effects. So there may be some functional aspects to that, but you'd have to look at it carefully. Functional explanations are tough. I mean, to really nail them down and to not have sloppy functional explanations is difficult. Yeah?
So do Marxist theories get criticized for using Marxist or functional explanations? Or why are you highlighting that it's a functional explanation?
They get criticized for, in effect, this particular way of formulating it is relatively new. Jerry Cohen, when he wrote Karl Marx's Theory of History of Defense, was the first person to fully realize and clarify the pervasiveness of functional explanations within Marxism. He got a lot of criticism from Marxists who wanted to refuse that there were functionalist explanations in Marxism, because functionalism has a very bad name on the left. Functionalism as a sociological tradition typically is associated with relatively conservative views. You know, why do we have gender inequality? It's because it serves valuable functions for the society. Right? So all sorts of forms of oppression are explained by their functions in a way that seems also to justify them, just because of their, quote, benevolent effects. Well, so functionalism has a very bad rep. Cohen was criticized for functionalizing Marxist theory. I think he's right, though, that this is at the heart of how we should understand the base and superstructure. Yeah?
So I'm just like trying to clarify, is the intent, or like the learning and like intent in that process, is that like a product that then feeds back into functionalism?
What it's doing is, you've got an arrow in this little picture. It's unpacking what's going on in that arrow. So we say anxiety produces rituals. Now the rituals reducing anxiety, the mechanism there is psychological. So there's something, you know, you have to still explore it, but we assume put a little psychological black box on the minus term there. And it's simply that there's some way in which believing that the gods are on your side and that you've done the rituals to propitiate the sea god or whatever reduces anxiety. And I think folk psychology gives us plenty of resources for that. The plus that goes from objective danger to anxiety of fear, well, that's simple. Why, you know, there's no big puzzle to be solved. Why is it that a dangerous activity makes you anxious? Duh. you know, just ordinary. I mean, I suppose there it's a biological evolution. We are the kind of creatures who are able to understand that connection. The puzzle is the, how does anxiety generate rituals in the first place? And that's where, if you really want to elaborate that part of the story, it's some kind of combination over a long period of time of trial and error, random stuff, and wise, I think of it as wise creative people who understand the structure of these relations, who in their inner spirit feel that there are spirits out there. So, you know, the part of the explanation is that as a species we have a capacity to imagine forces beyond ourselves and to animate those forces. I mean, there's been people who've talked about religious sentiment and spirituality and the imputation of divine powers to things as being evolutionarily part of our sort of neuropsychological dispositions, whether you buy that or not, some, you know, separate matter. But those insightful shamans over time invent things, and then they have enough perception to improve them and to realize which ones work and which ones don't. So that's the way that's described in the kind of literature about these things. That's elaborating the underlying mechanism in the feedback process. So you need some kind of elaboration to have a complete explanation. But if you're elaborating a picture like this, then you have a functional explanation. And this little picture, you know, with these three elements, an external danger or threat or destabilizing source, you know, something that's destabilizing, that's causing a problem, a resulting state of a system and a resulting structural solution. This kind of drawing, whenever you encounter a functional explanation, you should be able to draw a picture like this. Yeah?
Last thing first. So are you suggesting that despite the criticisms of functional arguments, that that's the way that we should think about the state from a Marxist perspective?
It's an aspect of how we should think about the state.
And it's not the only thing.
Not
like
the only
part,
right.
The way of conceptualizing.
Right, right.
Bring in other things.
Right, right.
Value.
It's a value. I think it provides valuable insights. It's never, it should never be a standalone explanation, and it should never be viewed as a final explanation, but it's part of a. I mean, this raises the under 2.3, this distinction between a functional explanation and a functional description. So, which is worth noting. Many people really dislike functional explanations because they're too easy to make. They can often be facile explanations. And they're very hard to prove or disprove. So it's easy to slide from a functional description to a functional explanation. A functional description simply points to a beneficial effects of something. So it's perfectly fine to say that rain makes flowers grow, that a beneficial consequence of rain is the thriving of flowers, or the flourishing of flowers, to use flourishing in its, I think it's etymologically connected to flowers. So we can say that rain is functional for flowers. It is functional for flowers. That's a description. There's nothing objectionable in that descriptive claim, but it would, most people would regard it as absurd to then conclude that that's why it rains. That's going from a functional description to a functional explanation. So this is one of, so there's a trap that a lot of anthropologists especially were subject to, since functionalism and anthropology grew up as, functionalism as a frame of thinking and anthropology grew up together. To say that rain dances among the Hopi Indians contribute to social cohesion, that rain dances produce cohesion, is a functional description. But to say that the existence of rain dances is explained by the fact that they produce cohesion is to offer a functional explanation. And the question is, what if you're skeptical? What if you say, no, I agree that rain dances generate cohesion, but I don't think that's why there is rain dances. It's just a byproduct of having rain dances. How do you defeat the functional explanation? Well, you can see it's a tough thing. It's very easy to move from a functional description to a claim about an explanation. It's much harder to actually say, well, yes, how do you prove that it is indeed the cohesion effects of rain dances that explains the rain dances? In the Malinowski case, there was a nice historical experiment, because when motorized fishing became possible, the objective dangers of the deep sea fishing declined. Now, if you have the functional explanation that says the reason for the deep sea fishing is because of rituals is because it reduces anxiety, if you have an exogenous reduction of anxiety, one would expect that over time the ritual should erode, that there should be, people would be less willing to devote resources to them. The rituals were expensive, they took time and energy. The rituals might continue because they served multiple functions. Let's suppose that the rituals were invented because they reduced anxiety, but they also just made people feel that they're part of a community and this is the way you've always done things, and it creates a sense of historical continuity. That wasn't part of the functional explanation initially. It isn't why the rituals were created and stabilized, but it was an additional byproduct. So here you have a case of rituals then serving two functions. You get rid of one of the functions because you've reduced the anxiety. Well, the rituals might just continue anyway, but you would predict that they would continue in a less vigorous form, that they're serving a less, you know, kind of critical function, and that you don't need that elaborate a ritual to just provide the sense of community. Well, that's in fact apparently what's happened in the Trobriand Islands, that the rituals have declined. They're done in a more perfunctory way. And that fits with the functional explanation, so it would add evidence to the original functional conjecture. The point about this distinction between functional explanation and functional description is that the observation about beneficial effects is not equivalent to demonstrating that those beneficial effects explain the phenomenon in question. But it does provide a basis for a conjecture about mechanisms which might underlie a functional explanation. If the functional explanation is correct, then there has to be some kind of feedback mechanism which explains how it comes to pass that the structure is reproduced by those effects. So it's a conjecture. And it's one that then leads you to look for evidence to support that functional reasoning. It may be very hard to do so. It may remain a conjecture. It may therefore have more the status of an interpretation of the phenomena being studied than a full-blown scientific explanation, but I think it still has a role. Well, this kind of explanation is very central to Marxian theories of the state. The state is, as a general observation, Marxists say, aha, we see the state doing all sorts of things that are beneficial to capitalism in two senses. A, it serves the interests of capitalists of that particular class, and B, it reproduces the system sometimes in ways that even capitalists might oppose. So sometimes the state acts in ways that's good for the system, but opposed by capitalists. Sometimes, more frequently, does things that serves the stability of the system and is supported by capitalists. So we see these observations. How do we explain these beneficial effects? We explain them by virtue of the functions that this serves for capitalism. That's essentially the core of a functionalist explanation. The external threat which is driving the system is, on the one hand, the instability of processes of accumulation. Capitalism is a deeply contradictory and destabilizing system and therefore needs something to keep it in place, and class struggle. People resist it. So it's class struggle and contradictions which are the equivalent of the danger of deep sea fishing. That threatens the stability of capitalist interests and accumulation, which stimulates the production of superstructures which stabilize the system. So it's, you know, you can draw the equivalent picture. It's a nice little exercise as you, you know, have this little template and then fill in the blanks when you hit different parts of the problem. Yeah.
So just to be clear, so the functional explanations, that's just like, that would be explaining why something's like happening now, but it might not be the case that, like, if the rain dance has started because they really just wanted rain, but they're still around, the functional explanation isn't, like, if you agree that functional explanations are fine or whatever, it wouldn't be wrong. You wouldn't say, oh, no, that's wrong because they actually did it because they wanted rain.
Well, no, so look, that's a nice illustration. We as modern Enlightenment scientists do not believe that rain dances actually generate rain. Right? Now, some people might say, no, it does really produce rain. They're operating under a different set of views about how the world works. I probably pretty good prediction that nobody here believes that rain dances actually increase the likelihood of rain. So it's fine to say the reason why the actors invented rain dances and performed them is because they believe that rain dances produce rain. But given manifestly that rain dances don't produce rain, why do rain dances continue? Well, the typical anthropological answer is that rain dances serve other purposes besides the ones that the actors see. So the actors have their own purposes. We want rain, let's do a rain dance. But really, the absence of rain creates deep conflicts and tensions in the community. What's really going on, and really means the deeper explanation, is that in a drought-prone environment, it's hard work to keep communities cohesive. What rain dances do is produce solidarity. That's the real effect of the rain dance, which explains why they continue. Not the production of rain. Now, if the environment changed and it became a wet climate with rain all the time, one would imagine that the rain dance as the mechanism for producing solidarity might change, that it might, you know, there'd be historical memory about how the rain dances eventually convinced the gods to produce permanent rain, and it would be a celebration of community spiritual connection with nature or something. You know, there'd be ways in which it would get reframed over time culturally. But it's because its function of producing community solidarity would remain intact, if that's the main function for it. So, but this reveals that you can see the trickiness of these kinds of explanations. It's easy for them to become just so stories. That's the criticism of functional explanations, is that they're facile. We're clever. We can always come up with a story. But you're just telling stories. You're not actually studying anything. So I do think that that there's a role, though. You know, this is a complicated terrain of thinking. I do think there's a role for functional thinking. One should just keep one's eyes open. There are three kinds of theoretical moves which I think, in Marxist discussions in the last 30, 40 years, which still accept some of the insight of the base superstructure model, where the state is understood and explained by its functions. So that's this functional explanation. So there's still an insight that comes from that part of the theory, but which modifies it in a number of ways. And I've summarized here in the notes three modifications which we will be encountering in different ways in subsequent lectures. And this also applies to the issues of ideology and culture. The same general kind of point. ideology used to be thought of in very functionalist terms in this way as part of the superstructure. Why are ideologies the way they are? Because they stabilize capitalism. Well, there's modifications, and these three modifications. First, the state is an arena of struggle, and this generates contested functionality. Struggles over the state and within the state impinge on the capacity of the state to fulfill its essential functions. So while the state still has a class character, its functionality is viewed as more problematic because of the way struggles are reflected inside of state policy and state structures. So I refer to this as contested functionality rather than smooth, untroubled functionality. Secondly, the state is a very complex system. It's not simple. And this leads to an argument about contradictory functionality. The state faces multiple demands to satisfy the needs of capitalist social reproduction, and it can't do all of the things it needs to do. Doing some things that are good for capitalism undermine other things that are necessary for capitalism. It's forced to engage in self-undermining practices. And we observe that all the time in the way the state's actions provoke crises of capitalism rather than just solve crises of capitalism. When the state does things, neoliberalism is a great example of this. Neoliberalism involves a set of policies which, on the face of it, looks like it's gung-ho pro-capitalist, serving the interests of capitalism with spades, but it also undermines the reproduction of capitalism. You know, and it's the contradictory functionality argument says this isn't an accident. It's because inherently the contradictory requirements for reproducing this kind of system are such that there is no possible smooth functional reproduction. There will always be these kinds of contradictions. And it may be that we've gone off the deep end in sort of an extreme form of this pathology of contradictory functionality right now. But this is a characteristic feature of the state. So the state is, the functionality is not just contested, it's incoherent functionality or contradictory. And then the third general modification of the simple base superstructure idea concerns the historical specificity of state institutions. So this, you can add another adjective to the list, it's contingent contradictory functionality. And we really, so we can, if you want to put the whole bit together, it's contingent, contradictory, and contested functionality, right? Class struggles impinge on the ability of the state to serve the ruling class, and the state has internally inconsistent functional requirements, and all of this occurs in historical time where institutions get built up which may be very functional at one point in time and then become dysfunctional at another point of time. And they're not so easily changed because of the way in which power relations in support of particular state institutions get created. There's an interesting instance of this, which I don't really know enough about to say much, but I was in the news yesterday in conjunction with the sort of catastrophic web failures around the Obama, you know, health reforms. A lot of this, of these problems has to do with neoliberal outsourcing. So the standard way in which a state now does a big project like this is to hire companies to do the work for them, rather than the state to have in-house capacity to produce a website of this complexity. Apparently there's some 80 contracts, subcontracts connected to this web project. And it creates all sorts of meshing problems, right? That outsourcing and the dispersion of the outsourcing is a consequence of neoliberalism, which says private actors can do everything better than the state, so when the state has to do something, at least it should outsource it rather than do it itself. And then in the American context, because of the way our capitalist mechanisms work in the state, the idea was to disperse it to many vendors rather than to have it give one giant contract to a single vendor. And all this is supposedly implicated in the problem. Well, Britain faced a similar thing, apparently, a few years ago. There was some major overhaul of the national health system's web services. It was a complete disaster. It was driven by the same neoliberal ideas. Lots of vendors, incoherent interfacing of their different programs. It was a mess. And they decided the only solution was to create an Office of Technical Innovation inside of the state, to create a cabinet-level post on, essentially on the digital needs of the state, and to hire hundreds of very high-end programmers to do this work in-house in a centralized way that supervised it all, and then to just subcontract outsiders pieces that were being allocated to them by a centralized web design team, right? So then you could ensure more effect, and apparently it has pretty rapidly led to a big improvement in the functionality of these state services. Well, that's a nice kind of example of how neoliberalism sheds the state of its capacity to do things. That creates all sorts of contradictory problems down the road. And in order to solve it requires a restructuring of the state in a small way, but a restructuring, which in the British case is actually a retreat from neoliberalism. You know, it's a pretty significant retreat, not in the sense that it's going to shatter the system, but it's an acknowledgement that there are important areas of activity which need to be not just produced for the public good, but produced by the public itself. So I'd like to know more about it. It was a nice little NPR spot. It seemed pretty interesting for these issues. Okay, that's our foray into the classical story. Yeah?
Well, I was just curious about that example. Like, how do you know that that's a retreat from neoliberalism rather than just stabilizing mechanism for neoliberalism?
Well, it's a less neoliberal. It's a stable, it may stabilize.
Because it's a property that's moved.
Yeah, right. In a centralized, publicly minded way where the actors, you know, these programmers are civil servants, they're hired by the state, they're in control of the whole process. And then they articulate some outsourcing to private firms. So there still is, it's not a complete rejection of neoliberalism, but it's a retreat from the full bore neoliberal program as privatization of everything, with the state providing certain kinds of resources. You know, so neoliberals do recognize there are public goods that need to be provided, but they should be provided privately through the market, and the state should simply facilitate that. You know, so this is a retreat from that. Okay. That's Tuesday's lecture, now complete. So that was clearly a 1.5 session lecture. We will turn to the super cool question. So, you know, I overdo this, I'm sure, by hitting various topics. I say, now, everybody wake up. This is a really cool topic. I think this question of what makes the capitalist state a capitalist state is a just intellectually really interesting idea. And it has ramifications for all sorts of other problems. And to see how theorists grapple with it and fumble a bit, you know, it's because these are not well nailed down questions. It's just a very interesting problem to grapple with. And that's what we will grapple with at 11:15.